This hour presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op and Hampshire Primary Interviews on the New Hampshire Now program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli.
Welcome to Pints and Politics here at the Barley House. 1-9-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints and Politics presented by New England College. Joined today by Dean Spildes in just a few moments. So we with Marianne Williamson, Democratic candidate for president, a spiritual advisor and healer, who came to fame as Oprah's spiritual healer during her time on TV. As we welcome Dean Spildes. Dean, how are you?
Hi, Chris. I'm doing well.
Great. What are your expectations for today?
I don't have strong expectations. I think this is a fascinating candidacy. It's sort of a little outside of the norm of what we typically see, although people said that about Donald Trump as well. So, I think it's going to be really interesting just to kind of get a sense of what her candidacy looks like in practice.
This is Pints of Politics here at the Barley House, 1-9-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. When we return, we'll be joined by Marianne Williamson, Democratic candidate for president.
This hour presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op and Hampshire Primary Interviews on the New Hampshire Now program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli. This hour presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op and Hampshire Primary Interviews on the New Hampshire Now program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli.
And welcome to Pints and Politics here at the Barley House on 1-9-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for Pints of Politics, which is presented by New England College. We're honored to be joined on the program today by Marianne Williamson. She is running for president, Democratic ticket, and she joins us on the program to discuss her candidacy. Marianne, great to see you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your time. And first off, kind of take us through the decision-making for you to run for president. You're an entrepreneur, a businesswoman, a spiritual advisor, and going into the political side of things. And it's been interesting. You know, you are extremely well known outside of politics, but in politics, political figures not knowing of who you are. So it's an interesting candidacy. Tell us about your decision making to jump into this realm.
It began with a moment, and that was rather shocking even to me, followed by a year and a half of processing. In a situation like mine, because I don't come from the political establishment, I knew there would be inevitable humiliation, inevitable embarrassment, inevitable mockery, inevitable mean-spirited stories, lies, bad pictures, and so forth. As my own daughter said to me, why do you need this, Mommy? But as that year and a half unfolded, I began to feel more and more that the calling of my heart, the calling of my spirit is to do this. And the conviction that compelled me to do it to begin with remains with me to this day. And that is a conviction that the dominant conversation within our political establishment is an inadequate container for the energies that we need now in order to navigate the times in which we live. I feel that the conversation I can articulate inspires the kinds of energies and changes that we need.
So you mentioned a moment where this kind of came to you. How would you define it? Was there a thought process prior to that, where or was it just something that said, okay, I'm going to run for president? How did that kind of evolve?
I'm sure that anyone who is doing this is doing so because they feel called by something deep inside themselves. Mm-hmm. This is not an easy thing to do, and it is challenging on so many levels that I'm not so sure it matters the exact nature of the moment or the thoughts as it is the fact that I, like I'm sure every other candidate, had to go through a lot within myself before deciding whether to take this on. This is not a time to play with people. This is not a time to play with people's emotions. This is not a time. This is a very serious and sober time and sobering time in American history. And I recognize that, and I would not be doing this to in any way play around with anybody.
What do you see as being the role of the President of the United States? And do you see yourself as an individual who would change that role and take on a different role, or would you act in a traditional form as we have come to, you know, see with presidents prior, say, to Donald Trump?
Well, we need to return to our democratic norms. We don't need to stray further from them. Franklin Roosevelt said that the primary responsibility of the presidency, the primary role, he said, is moral leadership. And he said that the administrative aspects of the job are secondary. So I believe what we need now is moral leadership. I believe we need a political visionary more than we need a political mechanic, and I would be that.
Marianne, before we talk about policy, let me ask a different version of that question. I've heard you say on a number of occasions from various interviews I've watched that the current conversation, the current dialogue is not serving a purpose anymore in this country, and you want to change the dialogue and have a different conversation. So going beyond that, beyond kind of force of personality, how do you change the conversation in terms of how would you engage our institutions, the presidency, interacting with Congress? Are we talking about building bipartisan coalitions on legislation? Are we talking about trying to change the underlying partisan distribution in Congress? So beyond you personally using force of personality to change the dialogue, what does that look like institutionally for all the other players that are involved?
I'm not talking about force of personality much at all. I'm talking about problem solving. And I have not said that the dominant conversation is outdated. I'm saying that it needs to be expanded. When our politicians mainly talk about issues as we define the issues, they're talking about symptoms rather than cause. They're talking about externalities. I'll give you a perfect example. Here in New Hampshire, you have a terrible opioid crisis, okay? And obviously, there are many conversations to be had around that, all of which I respect and participate in. But the truth of the matter is, as long as you've got hundreds of thousands of children living with chronic trauma, with unaddressed emotional, psychological, educational, even medical needs, what you're doing is just generating a new generation at risk for opioid addiction. So this is what I'm talking about, addressing what's going on inside people, causal levels of issues, so that we don't just wait until they're terrible things that have happened on the outside and we try to address just on the level of symptom. It's very analogous to when we shifted from a mainly allopathic medical paradigm to an integrative medical paradigm. We now know you don't just wait to get sick, you cultivate health. And that's what we need to do with our democracy. We need to bolster the issues that actually make us a healthier society, not just address the sicknesses that have obviously arisen.
So are you making any claims that you will be able to foster bipartisanship in a way that President Trump certainly has not, and even other presidents who have said that they would in the past have been unable to? Or is that almost an irrelevant question or a different question from when you talk about, I'm trying to understand what you mean by expanding the conversation.
Well, you're a political scientist yourself, so I don't need to tell you that all of that depends on who's going to be your Congress. If I'm a Democratic president and I have a Congress.
Let's say it's the way it is now. Let's say you're elected and it looks just like it does now.
Well, look at Barack Obama. I think there were places where he made every possible overture and was rebuffed. I mean, some of this is not just, you know, there are two people in a conversation. I can only be responsible for my part. I would certainly seek honorable debate. I would certainly not be demonizing people who disagree with me, but how other people reacted towards me, I'm not in control of.
Okay. That is Marianne Williamson, candidate for president, joining us here for Pints and Politics at the Barley House, which is presented by New England College. So you've referenced the opioid epidemic and the systematic problems that have been created and will be created in regards to the opioid epidemic, and I completely agree with you in regards to those. But I'm curious as to what you see as being, you know, the first item that you address. Is it in fact mental health? And how would that look in terms of expenditure and programs? Do you see as being one specific item that you're going to work on, say the mental health crisis? And that being kind of the impetus in the first 100 days, how do you see that?
Well, I assume you're discussing specifically in terms of the opioid crisis. Right now here in New Hampshire, you already got some federal aid on this public health issue. I would actually increase that. Mm-hmm. I also feel that there are issues involving disbursements, reimbursements that I think we need to recognize, rehab, et cetera, should be included. I also believe that we should have 24-hour 12-step recovery programming on television. The airwaves belong to us, particularly in rural communities where people might want to go to an AA meeting, but it would be too far to drive. Mm-hmm. They don't know where one. We could have 24-hour programming. This would be very good for kids when they come home from school. It would be very, very good for people in the middle of the night. We could have a very sophisticated technological situation with that, where you, through Zoom, through Skype, could actually participate in a 12-step meeting. Mm-hmm. I'm a big believer in the power of the 12 steps.
So would that be a government program, or would it be something that you...
The government... Well, I think we need to remember that the airwaves belong to the people. Mm-hmm. The way things have unfolded in the last few years, you think they belonged to these huge multinational corporate media mm-hmm. entities, but they don't. They mm-hmm. belong to us.
So, but in terms of the basis of the program itself, would it be something that's, you know, in terms of what was pushed forward, the 12 steps and the infrastructure and the planning and so forth, would that be something that you would initiate, or would it be you want to have private?
I think the main job of the president is to articulate a vision, to articulate mm-hmm. the project. The first thing is to make it clear that we are going to do something using the airwaves that belong to the people for 24-hour support, spiritual, psychological, emotional support mm-hmm. that not only has to do with treating people who are addicts, but also, I believe, could be very preventative. We have so many, I'll give you an example. We have so many media figures, so many pop stars, so many movie stars that these kids relate to, mm-hmm. you know, who have been there and aren't anymore. Mm-hmm. They could be on TV 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much, and I believe that part of what I could do as president, what any good president should do, is really harness the talent. We have profound creativity in the United mm-hmm. States. We have profound, profound productivity in the United States, but it's not being harnessed the way it could be harnessed. And I believe that whether it has to do with something that is paid for by the government or something that is paid for through other sources, but which the government promotes. These kinds of public-private, that's to me not as important as the creative thinking that has to do with something like 24-hour programming.
What would be your number one priority, though, in the first 100 days? Would it be the opioid epidemic and this type of a program that you're describing, or would it be something else, and how would you roll it out?
The first thing I do is probably call some European leaders and say, we're back!
Yeah.
And I think they'd probably be happy to hear that. Another thing I'd work on, you know, I want a complete shift of the economic paradigm that now dominates American economic policy. I believe that the way to have economic vibrancy in the future, and our economic system does not now plan for long-term economic vibrancy. It actually sucks from the future mm-hmm. by taking everything out of the present that's possible for a very few people. So for me, the way to take better care of your economic future 10 years from now is to take better care of your 10-year-olds today. So one of my first things would be to lay the ground for a cabinet-level U.S. Department of Children and Youth so that we are coordinating services, understanding of challenges, solutions that have to do with addressing the chronic trauma of America's children. And that would affect very much our economic councils, because I'm less interested in the economists who took us where we are, and I feel that the main economic gold and potential for our future lies in the brain of every child in America in every kindergarten. I think that elementary school teachers and child psychologists and early childhood experts should be on our economic councils. We now know things about the brain of a child that they simply did not know when our economic system was created. And beyond that, I would also work very, very hard. I would begin immediately in my relationship with both Palestinian and Israeli leaders so that both would feel heard and that I could participate as vitally as possible in taking the role that I think the United States should be taking of genuinely honest broker.
Following up a question on foreign policy, some people might assume, given your background and your writings as a spiritual advisor, et cetera, that you would be a dovish kind of president. How do you feel that you would fulfill the role of commander-in-chief, and would you be comfortable engaging foreign enemies in war if necessary?
Our current defense strategy has very little to do with creating peace 50 years from now or 100 years from now. Our national defense strategy is mainly focused on preparedness for war. Even Donald Rumsfeld, who was Secretary of Defense under George Bush, said we must learn how to wage peace. And James Mattis said before he left the Defense Department that if you're not going to fully fund the State Department, I'm going to have to buy more ammunition. You can't just fight sickness. You have to cultivate health. And you can't just prepare for war. you have to wage peace. The factors that are most significant in waging peace, actual peace creation, are expanding economic opportunities for women, expanding educational opportunities for children, fighting violence against women, reducing violence against women, and ameliorating unnecessary human suffering wherever possible. Statistically, the proof is there. When those elements are addressed, those situations are more peaceful. We now, for every dollar we spend on peace creation, we spend over $1,000 on preparedness for war. The way I see it, large groups of desperate people should be seen as a national security risk. Large groups of desperate people are more vulnerable to ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces. So for me, peace creation, it should be in robust partnership with the adequate and appropriate preparedness for war that we must have as a great nation.
So take me through what that would look like on the ground in Iraq and Syria, because you mentioned reducing violence towards women as one goal of peace, and we know there's been tremendous violence against women, certainly in the ISIS forces, kidnappings, etc., forced marriages, all that kind of stuff. We've all read the tragic stories.
And China.
China. So does that mean that would you be comfortable engaging ISIS militarily in order to protect women, or is there some other strategy in that arena that would lead towards the peace that you see?
First of all, I want to address this whole idea that a loving woman is somehow not tough enough to be commander-in-chief.
Well, that was my initial question, because that
well,
could
I know,
be the perception.
And I hadn't gotten around to that yet,
yeah,
and you
sure.
asked another question.
Sure.
When you look at the situation here in the United States, and you look how many fathers have abandoned their children, and you don't see anywhere near the same number of mothers. We have made very clear throughout history, and we make clear throughout the United States right now, we will do anything for our children. No one should doubt my ability as a mother. No one should doubt my conviction. No one should doubt my commitment. And I think this would be true of any woman. We're just as tough as men. You mess with our children, we're going to mess with you. In fact, a common anthropological characteristic of every advanced mammalian species that survives and thrives is the fierce behavior of the adult female of that mm-hmm. species when she senses the mm-hmm. threat to her cubs. You look at the mama bear, the lion, the tiger, you come after her cubs, she's coming after you. And that is how human women feel in our hearts. And that I would bring that sentiment.
Yeah, and for me, just to be clear, it's not a function from the question was not a function of your gender. It was a function of my sense of your writings and some of your past.
Dennis Kucinich had a very similar
sure,
approach.
Exactly. So that's what I was trying to get at. Some people may see that and say, well, how would she deal with ISIS, for example?
I think our most successful generals, if you look at someone like Dwight Eisenhower, what made him such a profound general was how much he hated war. Franklin Roosevelt led us through World War II, and he's one of his most famous quotes is that quote about "I hate war." Mm-hmm. To me, that's what makes military commanders the sort of deep personalities that they are. In terms of how you would engage, the world is a very complicated place, and every nation is a different situation. The one place where I have some ambivalence, I must say, has to do with the Taliban and women.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that it's a very difficult decision, and I think that military decisions are among those where often the president is faced with the choice between two bad options.
Mm-hmm.
This is an example of what's going on in Afghanistan today. So Americans want the troops to come home. We all would like to see that. So the U.S. government is now negotiating with the Taliban. The Taliban said that they would not allow the government of Afghanistan to be part of the negotiations. The United States, the conversation is that the U.S. is saying, we will withdraw our troops if you will promise that you will not let Afghanistan be a hotbed for Al-Qaeda or ISIS. Notice there's not even a conversation about American women. Afghani women. I'm very aware. I was aware long before 9/11. I was very aware of the barbaric treatment of women by the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
And I am heartbroken. I am heartbroken at what is, you know, I was speaking to some military figures, some very highly placed military figures who were talking to me about Afghanistan, and I asked that question. I said, well, given what you're saying, what the Taliban, obviously, the government of Afghanistan will not be able to stand on its own after American withdrawal. And I said, what's going to happen to the women? And there was silence. And then this man said, the women will be screwed, ma'am. To me, that is a very morally difficult issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I can't imagine situations where the use of our military for in response to profound humanitarian disasters would be off the table. The way I see the use of the military, I see number one when I see three things. I see number one when the safety and security of the United States is involved. Number two, when the basic human values that the United States should stand for are involved. And third, when a basic world order, issue of world order, in combination and connection with the rest of our allies, is at stake, as was true in World War II.
But two things off of that. Obviously, there's the economic, there's the military engagement side of things, there's the diplomacy side of things in dealing with nations that do not meet the standards set forth by the world in regards to the treatment of human beings. Would you not engage in a economic relationship with nations that do not treat women or human beings in ways that are appropriate?
That's first of all, that's a really profound question, and I want to acknowledge that. Thank you. Because what are you going to do? Do no business with China?
Right.
Do you know what
Saudi
I'm saying?
Arabia? Yeah.
Sure. Now, I'll tell you, on Saudi Arabia, I think the fact that for the sake of $100 billion in arms sales, mm-hmm. we were willing to do that when we absolutely know, and this is even beyond the obvious murder of Khashoggi, mm-hmm. the fact that the Saudi Arabians, with the aid of our aerial support, without which they could not be prosecuting that war in Yemen, where tens of thousands of people have starved, many of whom are children, I think that this is a complete sacrifice of America's moral values, and you better believe I would not do it. When Mike Pompeo, our Secretary of State, said, well, you can have strategic partnerships with people who do not share your values, no, you can't. So to me, that is such an egregious. To me, if I know that that you are using that gun to murder someone, mm-hmm. and I sell you that gun, I am complicit. So Saudi Arabia is an example. Well, absolutely, it's not a gray area. That would not happen if I were president.
One more thing on this, then we'll take a break and talk a little more about economic policy. As you referenced, because of your own personal beliefs in regards to peace and the value of individuals, it is, I assume, as you referenced, if there is a situation where you feel the need, you will use military action. But it is, I would guess, a personal prerogative to not want to use
military. As I would hope it
right.
would be for every American.
So if you are given actionable intelligence in regards to, say, a nuclear attack, or you had felt the need that you had actionable intelligence in regards to somebody who was going to perpetrate attacks, would you carry out a nuclear attack on another nation if you had
a nuclear attack?
If you had actionable intelligence that they were looking to say North Korea or another nation were looking to do something of that nature to us, a preemptive nuclear attack.
For us to drop a nuclear bomb on someone because we think they're going to drop a nuclear bomb on us, it's insane. You're still starting a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
So there's much that you can do before to even consider a nuclear option.
That is Marianne Williamson, Democratic candidate for president, joining us here on Pints of Politics here at the Barley House. I am Chris Ryan, along with Dean Spildes. We'll come back and talk about economic policy after this.
This hour presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op and New Hampshire primary interviews on the New Hampshire Now program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli. This hour presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op and New Hampshire primary interviews on the New Hampshire Now program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli.
Welcome back. It's Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, 139, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. Pints and Politics presented by New England College. Let's talk economics here in this segment of the show and get into some other topics as well. 21st century workforce is a big topic of conversation here in New Hampshire and across the country. Rural communities have been struggling for decades now after the shutdown of mills and plants. And have seen those jobs leave, and there's a lot of discussion as to how to reinvigorate rural America. What, in your view, is the best way to do that?
Well, there are a couple things you just talked about, because rural, I don't, you know, the small towns with the mills and so forth is not really what I think of as rural America. When I think of rural America and the problem, then I think a lot can be laid at the feet of the huge agricultural conglomerates who have basically stolen the dignity.
And this is an important topic that doesn't get talked about a lot, how consolidated the farming industry
agriculture
is.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Absolutely. And you can't get more primal and more it's significant for the human race and its relationship to itself than our relationship to food and our relationship to the land.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an example where corporate conglomeration has devastated this fragile bond between people. You know, we should see farming as, we should be reverent about farming. We should be reverent about the land. We should be reverent about the food. And this is just one of many areas where our advocacy and our slavish behavior of our government towards huge multinational corporate conglomerates has just hijacked the value system and possibly even the safety and the future of the American people.
So how would
I'm sorry.
How would you break up big agriculture?
We used to actually prosecute we have antitrust laws.
Right,
we have anti-monopoly. And in many cases, the issue is not so much that it can't be proven as that we have had a government and a political system that has wished for its own purposes to serve those conglomerates rather than to serve the cause of antitrust and justice.
So you would direct the Justice Department to prosecute?
Do its job?
Yes.
Yes, I would direct it to do its job.
Yeah, a couple questions. We're having a big debate here right now in New Hampshire over the minimum wage. New Hampshire doesn't have a state minimum wage. They rely on the federal minimum wage of 7.25, and there's just been a new a piece of legislation proposed over in the State House that will bump it up to $12 by 2021. Our governor, who's a Republican, we have a Democratic legislature, as you know, Republican governor, said he's not interested in a minimum wage increase. Is that part of your economic agenda,
absolutely,
or do you see it differently?
Yes, when I was growing up, somebody could work full-time at a minimum wage job and support themselves. Today, you could have a full-time job on minimum wage and not be able to support yourself, not be able to support. What are people supposed to do? And then we have these ridiculously skewed economic figures that say unemployment is down, but how many of those people are employed two or three jobs?
Mm-hmm.
I believe in raising it to $15
15,
an hour.
Okay.
However, I do recognize that there are places where that's too big a jump too fast.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a problem with some. I was in, I'm not sure. I travel so much right now. I think it's in Nevada where they're talking about going up to 14, or I wouldn't have a problem if it goes up to 15 and there's a temporary gap that is filled through federal compensatory measures. I mean, we have to, you know, there are many communities in this country, many different economic systems. An agreement that 15 is the goal, definitely.
Yeah, and the other big issue, and Chris may have some questions about this as well, but other big issue among Democrats is health care. So I wanted to get a sense of kind of where you are on the proposal spectrum. You know, we have Bernie Sanders at one end with Medicare for All. We're now hearing some Democratic candidates say, let's expand Medicare to start at age 50. Others who think we should just have a single payer or public option on the exchanges, and then others who kind of want to leave things as they are. Where are you? What are your ideas about health care, and where are you on that spectrum?
I'm with Medicare for All.
For All,
and,
okay.
And also I'd like to tell you why. I want to unleash the spirit of the American people. I want to unleash the productivity, the creativity of the American people of all ages that comes when people are unshackled. I want life to be easier on some of these levels so that people can have time to spend with their families, so that people can have time to participate in their community, have time to give themselves. Everything's too complicated. I want it to be very simple. I want it to be that if you get sick in the United States, it's handled. But also, I have to say, in addition to that, we... without a lot of complication, in other words, a lot of bureaucratic mm-hmm. mess. But also, I think we need to address, and this goes back into deepening the conversation, we're talking about health care, but we're not really. We're talking about sickness care.
Mm-hmm.
We need a health care system mm-hmm. in the United States. If you have a president who's really thinking about health care, then that president is not going to ignore the environmental policies, the chemical policies, the agricultural policies that do so much to create sickness, including giving back the real power to the FDA so that it can actually make a difference, as opposed to what it is now, having been so stripped of power that all it can do is just politely suggest that some huge corporation take a product off the shelves. And this is what I mean about we need to get far more real about what's happening in this country. So if we're allowing, you know, you have an EPA that has gutted the Clean Water Act, gutted the Clean Air Act, overturned the ban on pesticides that we absolutely know harm a developing child's brain, and then we're talking about how we're going to get how we're going to get health care, as in how we're going to treat the sickness. Once again, it's just one more area where we have to be willing to talk about cause, not just symptom. Too often politicians do not talk about the cause because it might offend some corporate sponsor.
And so the obvious question we always ask is, how would you pay for it?
Oh, please. You know, isn't it funny how the Republicans, when they want to do a $2 trillion tax cut, we're not supposed to say, how are you going to pay for it? Or $2 trillion war invading some country that didn't do anything to us. How are you going to pay for it? Every dollar we spend on education, every dollar we spend on any of these investments, whether it has to do with the Green New Deal, whether it has to do with education, and even if it has to do with health care, given how much of people's budget goes into health care, mm-hmm. is actually unleashing the productivity, the creativity, and the pocketbooks of the
American
people.
Wait, so it'll naturally pay for itself, or you'll have increased taxes?
There are various, whether it has to do with a small tax on when we buy stocks, whether it has to do with repealing those the tax cuts. We now have a $2 trillion tax bill from 2017. 83 cents of every dollar goes to the very, very richest and the richest corporations. I think that crowd has had 40 years to prove, and the evidence is in.
So something with revenue, probably something with revenue policy.
Yeah, so okay. I would repeal those tax cuts are the very richest, although I would permanentize the middle class tax cuts, which I think were a good idea and should have been done by the Democrats.
What do you think is the point of no return in regards to the debt? It currently sits at $23 trillion. How much more deficit spending can be done? Because I agree with you in regards to the wars and in regards to the tax plan, but I think that we can't continue to add on to the debt with new programs, and the debt is what it is, and it's
First
real.
First of all, you increase your consumer base, you unleash the creativity and the productivity of the people.
But this is how the Republicans said the tax plan was going to pay for itself, too. And it still adds money to the
deficit. I have never heard them actually explain how it's actually going to pay for itself, except some years down the road. Mm-hmm. I think what we're talking about, I think this austerity, I think there's a temptation, and we all know this. There's a temptation to constrict, sometimes at the very time when you need to not constrict too much. Mm-hmm. Then your brakes are going to lock, mm-hmm. right? So you unleash, you do everything you can. We need a massive infusion of hope in the American people. Then you have American people producing more, creating more, higher than they are. Themselves, they're themselves making more money, they are a higher consumer base, and they're a higher tax bracket. And then it's a process, but then we start to heal ourselves economically as well as every other level. You know, when it comes to economics as well as every other issue, do the right thing, mm-hmm. and it's amazing what you're going to see happen.
Yeah, I think you're completely right about the healing and hope side of things. I want to get to that in a second. One more thing, though, on the Medicare for All. One of the things that I think has some credence is that if a Medicare for All solution is pushed forth, that individuals will not have as much stake in regards to their own health and will be having even more of a sickness system. How do you develop a system that is based upon wellness and incentivize individuals to be well when their health care is free and they don't have as much incentive in regards to cost?
I think that's playing people very small. I think that's a very narrow-minded view of people. Mm-hmm. I don't think the average person thinks that if I don't take care of my health, I can just assume that medicine is going to be able to fix it. We have now achieved a paradigmatic change. We know that you have to cultivate health. You can't just not take care of your body and then get the inevitable sickness comes and just think that some doctor, especially in a Medicare for All situation, is just going to be able to miraculously fix it. People are not stupid.
I think, though, if you look at the current system and the overall health and wellness of individuals, a huge incentive is the cost of health care. And if you remove that
explain to me how that works. What behavior do you see that is more health-inducing or more, health-supportive mm-hmm. that you feel someone engages in because of the high cost of health care? Give me an example.
I feel that the businesses and individuals, once gyms became a part of the individual workplaces, and once wellness became a much more of a significant part of the workplace and a aspect to drive down cost, individuals started to focus more on wellness. If you've had a situation where you've been hospitalized for a period of time, and there's both the psychological aspect of it, of I don't want to be back here, and there's also the cost side of things of, oh, this is perhaps something that's preventative. So I feel that individuals are driven both, as you mentioned, by doing the right thing, but there's also the cost side of things, and that's a piece of the pie. It's not driving you
entirely.
Yeah,
I hear what you're saying. I think that people started going to the gym because we know that this is how to cultivate health. I think that's true, and to the same extent, whether you have health care or you don't. And nobody wants to go back to the hospital if they don't have to. Nobody says, well, it's paid for, so what do I care if I go back to the hospital? People don't want to go to the hospital if they don't have to.
That is Marianne Williamson, Democratic candidate for president. Joining us here for Pints and Politics, the Barley House, presented by New England College. I think you made a great point in regards to hope, and I love the aspect of your campaign that is focused on healing and kind of changing the direction of our country right now, which publicly is one of vitriol, of divisiveness, of one side versus the other. And I'm curious as to what your overarching themes would be in regards to bringing the country together, and if there's particular projects or initiatives or overall thinking.
That brings us back around to our initial set of questions,
right.
Really, about I'm still trying to understand what this would look like in practice in terms of engaging politics on the ground, because we do have such a difficult environment right now, and it's not clear to me that Democrats aren't looking for some kind of payback after a rough couple of years with President Trump. So I'm just wondering, you can follow up on Chris's question, but I think we're both trying to understand kind of at a conceptual level, I think what you say is very appealing. I'm just trying to understand the nuts and bolts on the ground.
The tenor of the president's conversation has a huge effect on the psyche of a nation. And nowhere
sure,
do you
rhetoric's
see it.
A very important part
you
of
never,
it.
Yeah, if you want to look at a perfect example of that, look at the president we have now. Just as a president who speaks in a very low-minded, narrow-minded, mean-spirited way affects people, I think a president who speaks in a more high-minded, noble, and loving way affects people as well. I think the president Eisenhower was correct when he said that the American mind at its best is both liberal and conservative. Mm-hmm. Nobody owes it to you to agree with you about politics or anything else. That's what a free society is. We don't have to agree. And I think all of us need to get off our high horses, both liberals and conservatives. A smug, self-righteous, intolerant left-winger is no less damaging to the emotional fabric of this country than a smug, self-righteous, intolerant right-winger. Mm-hmm. I think all of us need to spend a little less time pointing the finger at others, and a little more time monitoring our own hearts. And I would try to display that, and also to inform the American people who might not. I can't imagine that anybody really needs to be informed, but clearly they do. The problem in America today is not high-minded conservative principle. It is not high-minded liberal principle. It is a kind of authoritarian corporatism, which has no more respect for conservatives than it does for liberals. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of, there was then something that you said just now, sir, and I can't remember that your follow-up to him.
No, I'm just trying to conceptually understand what you're saying, and I'm just trying to understand what that looks like in day-to-day politics, the kind of nuts and bolts of governing and interacting with Congress.
Basically, like policy-wise.
I do understand your point about how changing the tone. Presidents do have an important symbolic and rhetorical role. Just simply changing that could have an effect.
You know, when you look at my website, you see more specific policy prescription there than you do on the website of any other candidate. Mm-hmm. I'm very clear about what I want to do on a practical basis. Mm-hmm. I want to develop a cabinet-level U.S. Department of Peace. I want to have a very serious conversation about paying reparations for slavery. I want a...
What would that look like?
Well, I believe that what we should do is have a council that would be very important, and it would not be done quickly or impulsively. Mm-hmm. A council, a board of trustees, as it were, a reparations council of black leaders, some of whom have done scholarly work over the last few years on the subject of reparations, black leaders chosen from across the board of culture and academia and politics, who would be, after a negotiation, the money that would be given would be stipulated that it be dispersed by this council over a period of, let's say, 20 years for projects of economic and educational.
So it wouldn't go to individuals, it would go to communities.
Well, you know, there are two ways to answer that question, and both are important. On one hand, if I owe you money, I don't get to tell you how to spend it. Mm-hmm. And I think, but I do think that when you're handing over that much money, the United States government does have, and America has the right to say, there is some stipulation here, and it is educational and economic renewal projects, yes.
How would you go about...
Oh, I'm sorry. And if I may, when you talked about the nuts and bolts, when we talk about actually increasing funding for projects that expand economic opportunities for women, expand educational opportunities for children, reduce violence against women, ameliorate unnecessary human suffering, all these diplomatic and humanitarian efforts, even establishing domestically a United States Department of Peace, I think that my plans here are very practical, because my perspective on love is that it doesn't mean anything if it's not practical.
How would you go about engaging with Donald Trump? This is a question we've been asking all the presidential candidates, and each...
Oh, that's where his question came. Yeah, I remember. Right.
So
okay.
Each individual has their own thoughts and philosophy, and you know, for some, it is strictly taking the higher ground. For others, they believe that you have to get into the mud of Donald Trump and punch harder than he punches. How would you go about dealing with them?
I think that Michelle Obama was right when she said, when they go low, we go high. Mm-hmm. I think Michael Avenatti was totally wrong when he said, they go low, we go lower. I think that it is very naive to think that you are going to defeat this president by simply being tough enough. This is almost childish, and it shows a very unsophisticated understanding of the nature of the opponent. I don't believe the American people need me to tell them who Donald Trump is. Everybody is very clear who Donald Trump is. What I seek to do is to articulate a vision for an America that is much more beautiful than the one he has created, one in which we've returned to our goodness, our democratic values, and our universal human values. I see this presidency as an unfortunate episode in American history, and let us close it as soon as possible at the polls and go about the work of restoring and repairing our nation.
Would you pardon President Trump convicted of crimes?
Absolutely not. I actually believe that Gerald Ford, although I think Gerald Ford had good intentions, I do believe he was coming from a good place in his heart. I think it was a mistake to pardon Richard Nixon, because it short-circuited justice. And I think that, you know, it's kind of like, I think this country has never really recovered from the fact that we don't really know who killed Kennedy. Mm-hmm. I think this country has never really psychically recovered from the fact that pardoning of Nixon so fast. You know, mm-hmm. Justice is important. Justice has moral force. When justice is done in the people, that's part of one of the reasons why I support reparations. So justice has, and doing the right thing, has moral and spiritual and psychological and emotional effect on the psyche of a nation.
Dean, conclusion?
Just a final question. I'm still thinking back to what you said before, and I just going to press you a little bit. So you want to establish a Department of Peace that would need to be an act of Congress. Any payments through a Reparations Council would have to come from Congress. I'm trying to imagine the current Republican Senate approving any of that.
No, I can't.
So my question is, what's the plan B if you don't have a Democratic Congress?
Well, I tell people all the time, don't send me there unless you're going to send Democrats.
Well, that's the question. I mean, what's the plan B for a divided government?
But if I may.
Sure.
The idea of a Department of Peace would be 2% of whatever that year's military budget is. So it's when you think of how much of our military budget includes expenditures that the military isn't even asking for, I don't think that that's taking away from our money. I think it is adding to our success, adding to our peace, and even adding ultimately to our
economic vitality. And the State Department's not capable of filling those functions?
State Department has to do with international diplomacy. A U.S. Department of Peace would have to do with domestic. We need conflict resolution, restorative justice, wraparound services, et cetera, in terms of our domestic as well as our international situation.
Well, Marianne, really appreciate your time. Look forward to talking to you again here through the course of the process.
Thank you.
Best of luck, and we'll see you again soon.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Marianne Williamson joining
very
us
very
here
much.
For Pints and Politics at the Barley House on 139 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. Pints and Politics presented by New England College.
This hour presented by ARP New Hampshire, as well as the Concord Food Co-op and New Hampshire Primary Interviews on the New Hampshire Now program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli.
Welcome back. This is Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, 139-1450 and nhtalkradio.com. We're just joined by Marianne Williamson, who is very well known, draws big crowds across the state of New Hampshire. James Pindle just ranked her as being 7th on his top 10 list of Democratic presidential candidates, and she has a huge following of individuals across this nation. 2.1 Twitter followers.
2.1 million?
2.1 million.
Wow.
2.1 would be a lot.
That's good. That's closer to my Twitter following.
2.1 million Twitter followers. And she is a significant figure, and one that is well outside of the political lane that we travel in, but well known across this nation. and I think a interesting candidacy, and one that is well outside of the realm of what we normally see from politicians, which in this current environment we have seen be very successful.
Yeah, and she's keeping a busy schedule. She's drawing good crowds. I'm looking at her schedule right now. She's very active all around the state. I think she was a very smart, thoughtful. I think conceptually a lot of what she says will appeal to Democrats. The devil is always in the detail, and trying to figure out how that would play out in practice in an administration, I think, will be the challenge.
Very smart, very articulate, and very passionate as well. It's going to be interesting to see how her candidacy plays here in New Hampshire and across the country. This has been Pints and Politics here at the Barley House, presented by New England College. I am Chris Ryan. Have a great rest of the day, everybody.